You are now online with Andrea, with your host, Andrea Garrison.
Good afternoon. Welcome. You are now online with Andrea. I am your host, Andrea Garrison, and I'd like to encourage all of our listeners to practice the universal law of giving by doing whatever you can to reach out to help others. Our topic today is the book, Transformational Power of Dreaming, Discovering the Wishes of the Soul, by Stephen Larson and Tom Verner. And our guest today is Dr. Stephen Larson. Well, hello there, Stephen. How are you today?
Hi, Andrea. I have done, I don't know how many shows with you now, but as we started out by saying, because we were a little displaced with the time, this felt a little bit like one of those dreams where you're always trying to get somewhere and one obstacle after another gets in your way.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of like a waking dream, right? That's what we just experienced. But
one of the things we could say to start with is that the sense of time is so different in dreams that people get disoriented by that first off.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to read an excerpt from your book, if I may. And we don't know what Lucy dreamed. That is to say, our ancestress, who lived probably 3 million years ago, walked upright during the day like we do, and probably lay down at night as we do. And no doubt she dreamed, as do all mammalian organisms. What we do know is that her children and grandchildren survived, and her great-great-grandchildren, to the extent of thousands of generations, survived. We ourselves are the manifest outcome of this process. So although we don't know what Lucy dreamed, according to neurobiology, we know that our species has likely been dreaming for at least 3 million years. From the archaeological records we have and the examination of contemporary shamanic societies, we are led to believe that most pre-literate people valued their dreams and visions far more than we do, as most precious gifts from the universe. We know that they dreamed, but we have no idea when they began to share their dreams or deliberately use them to solve problems. As best we understand, they didn't really have much else in the way of resources. Something allowed those many generations to survive: larger brains, opposable thumbs, the use of tools, social bonding, and astonishing creativity. None of these attributes may be discounted, but neither can we, in our dream impoverished and dream degenerating society, omit that their rich dream life and appreciation of same may have tipped the balance in helping the naked, relatively helpless creatures survive. By the end of this book, if we, the authors, have done our job well, you will have little doubt that dreams are one of humankind's most valuable allies. And that's a mouthful. So,
bring my own words, read by you, and in such a very literate and elegant way. I know that you always read every book of mine that you've ever reviewed, and sometimes astonished me with the detail that you were able to glean from the pages. And it's almost like you know my writing better than I do.
Well, I love your writing. So you've got to tell me, though, at what point did you realize the power of dreams? And please share with us one of your most memorable dreams and how it impacted your life.
Well, you know, I do tell the story in one of the later chapters in the book on lucid dreaming. I can't remember exactly which one. But when my cousin and I, my cousin lived with us because his father had died 2 weeks before he was born, and my dad kind of adopted him into our family. And we had a kind of a folie à deux, which means that we both had the same dream. Now, the dream was quite curious. The dream was that you're a little boy, and you're out alone in an Arctic landscape with the, you know, the wind blowing and the snow coming down, or wind coming from the forest, and you're trying to run to catch up with your parents, but they seem to recede away from you, or you never can quite get them. And then suddenly, with an ominous noise, a swish, swish, swishing noise, comes this terrible old hag on skis. Now, you can't make this thing up. It comes from probably the depths of the collective unconscious. And my cousin and I both had the same dream, and we came to call her in our shared dreamscape or mythology. You know, Joseph Campbell said that a myth is a shared dream, and a dream is a personal myth. So we would talk about this and how terrible it felt to be paralyzed and not be able to call out for your parents as this horrible, nightmarish creature approached. We didn't think that she was a friendly creature. And so one day, as my cousin and I were talking, my mother, who was quite a wise being, actually overheard us, and she came over with a kind of a funny little smile on her face, and she said, "I have an idea for you. The next time," she knew it was a recurring dream, "the next time that you dream about the ski," she said, "why don't you ask her why she doesn't drink Sanka coffee so she doesn't stay up all night terrifying little Norwegian-American boys?" Now, I didn't understand that, but that night when I went to sleep, it was like I had a secret talisman. So there I was, sure enough, out in the open Arctic landscape, and my parents were way ahead, and I was trying to get to them, but my feet were slipping, and I was calling out, but no sound came out, and swish, 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 the ski began to come closer. Now, this time I didn't, you know, desperately continue trying to run away. I sort of stood my ground, and as she came closer, I just stood there. It might have surprised her a little bit, but she grabbed me by the scruff of the neck and lifted me up to look into her kind of hideous face, and she said, "Aha!" And I said, why don't you drink Sanka coffee so you don't scare little Norwegian-American boys? And she went, "Ah!" and threw me down into the snow. And that was, then I woke up. Ah. And that was the last I dreamed of her.
But that's a powerful dream. I mean, you would never forget that, you know?
I would never forget it, but it wasn't until years later, when I was already studying mythology with Joseph Campbell, that I came across the figure, the nightmarish figure of Skadi. She is a goddess, but not a nice one. I think she's descended from the race of the Jotun, the giants. And she likes to grab little children, and if she gets a chance, she'll eat them or certainly terrify them. So I hadn't known her name until later, and I hadn't read any books of myths, so my parents did not read any particular myths about Skadi to us. So that was a genuine Jungian archetype of the collective unconscious that came boiling up somewhere from the recesses of my psyche.
Yeah. So tell us, what inspired you to write this book? And what was your approach in developing the book, and then how did you team up with Tom Werner to write it?
Okay. Well, I'll try to answer those in sequence. I have always wanted to write a book on dreaming since I was a little kid. And even as a young adult, I began keeping a dream journal. So I discovered about a year or two ago that my complete dream journals last over 50 years. And in the early part of those years, I was in my 20s, I worked as an intern at the C.G. Jung Foundation, and I was in analysis with Dr. Edward C. Whitmond, who was one of the foremost dream analysts in the foundation, and boy, was he good. He was just drop-dead accurate with everything that he picked up from your dreams. In fact, he wouldn't train me as an analyst unless I used dreams in almost every session. So you don't just wait for the person to come in and tell you what they think is going on. You say, could I have a dream, please? And then you ask them to associate to the dreams, and boy, does the psyche open up and like that. So the process has a kind of a continuity and a richness of psychic material. And so I learned how to do that. And then when I became a practicing psychotherapist myself, and I taught classes, college classes in psychology, I always included a section on dreams. Students have come to me years later and said, boy, that was the most informative class. That was a class that taught me about my life. It didn't just teach me about stuff. It taught me about living. And thank you so much. That was a great thing. So while I was doing that, one of my best friends, I think I met him in the 1960s, was another psychologist named Dr. Tom Werner. And we became friends and met at a place called the Country Place, which appears in one of the later chapters, and if we have time, I can tell you that story. And for some reason, I didn't know why, I was invited by Stanley Krippner, I think because I had just finished my PhD. Stanley invited me down to meet the new candidates for a PhD from the Institute for Humanistic Psychology, now called the Saybrook Institute. And one of the people I met there was a wonderful practicing magician named Tom Werner, and we just immediately hit it off. And he came to visit us first, I think, near New Paltz. So it's about 2 hours from Litchfield, Connecticut. And then pretty soon, he and his girlfriend at the time decided that they liked New Paltz area well enough to come move here. And so Tom had a place where he taught magic and did workshops called Seedbone Farm. And we had a place called, my wife Robin and I had a place called the Center for Symbolic Studies. And so we traded workshops back and forth. And Tom was in some of my early workshops and I was in some of his early workshops. He taught my son, aptly named Merlin, how to do sleight of hand magic so he could entertain his friends and while away the time. So we became really quite good friends, and when I got the contract for this book, I decided I've got to ask Tom to co-author it with me.
Oh, yeah, it's beautiful collaboration. Now, some people will say that a dream is just a dream and nothing else.
Share with us the
potential reality of dreams and what it means for us in terms of understanding our past, our present, as well as our inner desires for our future, perhaps.
Well, I think that's true. Now, I'll go ahead, since I kind of primed the pump a little bit, I'll go ahead and tell the story of Tom's dream involving Dr. Renee Nell, who was trained also by Edward C. Whitmond, as I was. She was a Jungian-oriented psychologist, analyst. And so Tom had studied with her and was analyzed by her. he was never analyzed by Whitmont, but he worked with a well-known psychologist who taught journal working workshops by Ira Progoff, pretty famous in his day. He's written a number of books. And so anyway, Tom started out as a as a Jesuit altar boy. He's Roman Catholic. I was raised Protestant, and then I think both of us kind of came to a new understanding of our relationship to spirituality or religion. But Tom worked with Rene Nell, and he found it incredibly powerful. Then he moved with a group of friends out to the West Coast, and I think he was out in the San Juan Islands or the Queen Charlotte Islands, somewhere off the West Coast in the Pacific, and he started the community there. Meanwhile, I stayed on the East Coast, and one evening he had a dream, and he regularly records his dreams, so it wasn't unusual for him to record this particular dream. And then he kind of closed his book and put it away, and didn't think anything of it until he came east on a visit, and he stopped in to see his old analyst, Rene Nell. And she was a pretty famous woman in her day. She ran this place called a country place where disaffiliated teenagers and kids who had been a little at risk or in trouble could come and take workshops and learn from, you know, really interesting teachers. And so Tom was visiting Rene, and in character, she said, "Tell me, Tom, have you had any dreams?" And he said, "Well, let me see. I had one, I think, involving you a couple of months ago, or I can't remember how long ago, it was weeks or months." And she said, "Well, tell me." So he pulled out his dream notebook, and he read the following thing. I'll paraphrase it. He said, "I was back in the country place, 3,000 miles away, and I seemed to be, I wasn't aware of my body, but I was hovering around and watching everything that happened. And you, Rene, were about to start leading a dream group. And someone from the kitchen, I don't remember her name, but a very specific person from the kitchen, picked up a phone call, got white in the face, and came across the floor and came up to you, Rene, I've got to talk to you." And she said, and I could, Tom said, I could hear with kind of an inner type of hearing that she told you that your brother had just died. And Rene went ashen, I guess, in the dream. And I still wasn't wearing a body, so to speak, but I kind of imagined myself in the dream going over to hug you. You gave me so much that I wanted to give back to you. And then Rene turned white indeed, because she said, "Let me take a look at the date on that." Mm-hmm. And they compared the date, and she said, "On that day, the exact thing you experienced in your dream happened. So-and-so, let's say Jane from the kitchen, came over as I was about to start my dream group, and she said, Rene, your brother, I heard that your brother just died. I'm so sorry to tell you like this, just as you're about to lead a dream group. And I didn't think I could do it. But then, as I walked across the floor to talk to the group, I felt sort of unconsciously, I felt a sense of comfort and warmth. And I felt embraced, and I felt like it was you there." I'm getting moved emotionally as I talk about this. And she said, "And then I had the strength to go to the group and to carry on as usual. I told them what had happened. They all were deeply sympathetic. And they appreciated the fact that I took the group seriously enough to, under those circumstances, listen to their dreams and work with them. This happened the exact day, the exact time, the exact same person from the kitchen came over. And she said, and now I know where I got that strength from, Tom. That was from you.
Mm. Wow.
So you don't have too many like that in a lifetime, you know?
No. No, it's special.
Yeah, and it has not only a precognitive aspect, but it has the aspect of knowing something at a distance and waiting weeks and months to actually verify it. And it strengthened their bond. And Tom said to her, you have given me so much. I had to hug you. And she said, now I know that you really care.
Yeah. Yeah, that's beautiful. Are all... Are all dreams important and integral in gaining a deeper understanding of self and others?
Probably the wise thing to say would be yes, because that's the position that Edward Whitmont took. Somebody would dream of a cream-filled donut. Seems like a silly thing to dream about. And then Whitmont would get a kind of a hunch, and he would say, I want you to play that donut. I just look ordinary on the inside. I look ordinary on the outside, but inside I have something very soft and sweet. And then the person would get moved emotionally, and Whitmont would say, I want to hear more about your sweet side. And so and a very ordinary dream could contain an image that, taken further, would introduce you to something that you didn't know about yourself. Now, Carl Jung differentiated between little ordinary dreams and what the Naskapi Indians of the Labrador Peninsula called big dreams. Big dreams, ordinary dreams are ones you, oh, I better write this down or I'll forget it. Big dreams, you don't forget. They stay with you. You can't forget them because they're so emotionally meaningful. And those kinds of dreams, I say, are especially important, but the ordinary ones may be important too.
Right. Yeah, that's true. So I guess it is, it's good to say yes, they are important. Because I guess we don't always know what they mean either. You know, they're...
And
sometimes we don't understand them until much later.
That's correct. Like, right. For example, Tom's dream took him by surprise. He didn't know. He was involved in his life out on the West Coast. And he didn't call Renee, but he found out later that the dream that he had was a true dream. Now, dreams either speak the direct truth. I'm not in agreement with Freud when he says the dreams are a disguise that is trying to hide something shameful and secret from you that you don't know, like an Oedipal wish or something like that. I suppose Oedipal dreams or Electra dreams do happen, but that's not all that they're about by any means. And sometimes they are precognitive. Sometimes they are clairvoyant. And you don't want to just diminish them or put them down by saying, just a dream.
Right. Yeah. You say that in perhaps the earliest recorded dreams, we see an early intimation of the connection of dreams with death, the underworld, and rebirth.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, think of this. When you lie down to sleep at night, you go on a journey that may be vast, it may be to other times and places, it may involve encounters with people that you knew long ago and are now dead. It may involve visits to lands you have never been. And so it always involves the idea of a journey. Now, the Night Sea Journey of the Soul is connected with the West and with the setting sun. And Greek mythology says that the family called the Oniroi, O-N-E-I-R-O-I, the family of pre-god and goddesses, they sort of belong to the family of Titans in the Greek mythology of Hesiod, that they are a family, they all live in a cave on the western sea facing the place where the sun goes down, and they are called Somnus, S-O-M-N-U-S, Hypnos, Morpheus, we know Morpheus from the movie The Matrix. He's a sort of a mysterious, powerful character in that. And then there are two people that nobody likes to really think about. They are Phaethor, the god of nightmares, and Phantastos, the god of delusions and dreams, crazy delusions and dreams. And those are all a kind of a family, because sometimes it's hard for us to tell the difference between a daydream and a night dream. Sometimes it's hard to tell the difference between a schizophrenic delusion and a dream. And so they're all associated with far-reaching excursions of the human psyche. When you close your eyes and enter that state, which is a simulacrum, if you will, of death. And so the missing brother that I didn't name is Thanatos, death himself. Death is also called the brother of Eros. So Eros is life and Thanatos is death.
Mm. Yeah. You're so great at telling stories, I can listen to you all day, Stephen, just like I could read your books. I love reading your books. But so tell us, how have dreams helped us to understand history, and how has history helped us to understand dreams?
Well, the first chapter I start with there is from the earliest recorded book of dream interpretation in the world. It's about 1200 BC in Egyptian manuscript. There's an Egyptian papyrus. I got a photo or an illustration of that in the book. And it's not like a modern book of dream interpretation, but it does tell us that dreams mean something. In that ancient society, if, for example, you look out the window and you're unlucky enough to see a black dog, it says in the book, that means you're going to die. So you'll find that I'm not quite so literal or literalistic about dream interpretation. I have to go deep into the psyche and find out what the dream means for that particular person. So if you are unlucky enough to pick up a book on dream interpretation and you pick up that book, and you have dreamt of a black dog, you're not supposed to drop dead on the spot.
Right. Yeah.
How did the author of that book know what a dog means to you, and off in the future or in a different context, a different landscape? So I'm not in favor of literal dream books. If you dream of a train, that means you're going on a journey. If you dream of a horse, that means you're you're supposed to be carried in a primitive way somewhere. No, I mean, a horse is one thing for a person who has grown up on a horse farm, still something else for somebody who goes to the racetrack at Saratoga on weekends and bets on the horses, still something different from a city dweller who's never seen a horse.
But it could be constant, because in the case of my mother, if she had certain dreams, she would say, someone's going to die. And she would see, something in her dream. And It always meant that someone was going to die, and it always did. So for her, and I never really compared, looked in a dream book to see, but for her, that particular dream meant someone was going to die, and then someone in the family would pass away.
Yeah. Well, she wouldn't know who it was in particular, would she, or would she sometimes?
No, she didn't necessarily know who it was, but she had a strong inclination, because she would wake up and the next day she said, oh, somebody close is going. Someone in our family, I can feel it. And then we'd get like the call that day that someone just passed away. And she was spot on all the time. Anytime she had the dream. And even if there was a family, oh, someone's pregnant, we've got some new family member coming. She was always right.
Yeah, well, she was a shaman lady.
Yeah.
She was a wise woman. This allows me to kind of jump ahead in the book to a later chapter in which I talk about Harriet Tubman and about the African-American tradition of dreaming, because African-Americans carried with them from their country of origin a belief in the value and the precognitive quality of dreams, and this is part of who they are. And Anthony Shafton has done a very interesting job of research in which he finds that African Americans have a whole different relationship to dreaming than white people do. White people tend to dismiss the dreams. The African American goes, "Uh-oh, something's up."
Right. Right. Yeah. And then you talk about interpretation. I was always fascinated that she would say, I dreamed of this and this means this, you know. And she didn't, and after growing up with that, I can remember even getting a dream book. And I didn't see necessarily the symbols that my mother saw. So I thought that was interesting, but...
You're not supposed to get a dream book and then get discouraged about dreaming, because it may not correspond to your personal journey, which is why I'm also against psychotherapists or casual dream interpreters who are all too quick to jump at what the meaning of the dream is. In order to work with a dream, you have to really, in a sense, inhabit the psyche of the person, of the dreamer, with them, and then allow that interpretation to be the thing that comes up between the two of you, and then you may have a sense of what it is talking about.
Yeah. In your book, you say there are no false dreams. No false dreams.
That is what that archaic and wonderful dream interpreter Synesius says about the dreams. There are no false dreams. There may be misinterpreted dreams. And in that same chapter, I talk about the the dreams of Penelope, who dreams her husband Odysseus is about to come home against all hope after 20 years of being gone, 10 years in the Trojan War and 10 years at sea being carried about by the currents here and there, and it's too much for her to hope for. So she brings out this ancient Greek belief that if the dream came through the gates of ivory, even though it's a fair and lovely gate, the dream could be false or based on wish fulfillment. But if the dream comes through the gates of horn, you better look carefully and think twice, because the dream may have something true to tell you.
Yeah. Now, you also discourage the use of the term nightmare.
Yeah.
So, well, yeah, go ahead.
But people, among my students, among the people who take dream groups with me, and you can find, we announce those periodically on our website, the Center for Symbolic Studies, symbolicstudies.org, or we sometimes announce them on my therapy website, stonemountaincenter.com. that we're going to have a dream group, and that's where I meet with either therapists, artists, writers, and we work on dreams together. And so I teach the students not to call a dream a nightmare. Call it a dream that's trying very hard to get your attention. That's why it's, And I shouldn't say that there are no nightmares. There, people experience what they would call nightmares, being stuck in a place you can't get out of, or there's a horrible monster or something bad coming and you can't get away from it, and so on and so forth.
You know, it's interesting. I've always thought that when you have a dream that seems terrifying, that sometimes we're here to learn certain lessons. And I've always believed that sometimes we get it, you know, in the physical state, and sometimes we're spared it physically, but we get it in the dream state. But regardless, it's still a lesson, and it still can be very intense, whether it happens when you're awake or if you're asleep. And often the same lesson is learned, whether it's in the dream state or the physical state. I've always kind of believed that.
Edward Whitmont would say, very often something that's on your horizon, so to speak, appears to you first as a dream, and if you get it there and work through it, you may not have to do it as a living experience. It's as if there's a realm of mythic images and ideation from which our dreaming comes, and yet we're not always certain that we're not dreaming when we're awake, because sometimes waking consciousness becomes dreamlike. For example, for me, last night at about 4 or 5 in the morning, I started thinking about Kim Jong-un, who is menacing the world with nuclear war right now.
Right.
And our president isn't doing a much better job of not doing that literally either. But So I dreamt about it, and I took it into a Tolkien-like scenario. Imagine that there's like a kind of an evil wizard living up near the North Pole, and as a matter of fact, Kim Jong-un identifies himself with the sacred mountain, Mount Paektu, which is up there in North Korea on the border of China. It's said to be a frosty mountain, an old volcano, and haunted by the spirits of the Kim family. And so it's bound up with North Korean mythology and shamanism. And now here's a guy who has tunneled out in the mountains and is preparing a nightmare for all of us that he may try to spring on us at some point or other. And it's a little bit like J.R.R. Tolkien's Land of Mordor, where an evil spirit is creating a military force to conquer the world. I mean, waking reality becomes very mythic and very dreamlike at times.
Yeah. I mean, there are people who will say that they saw this in a dream and then they carried it out. So dreams are very real indeed, right?
Well, I have a whole chapter in which I detail. It's called the Cauldron of Inexhaustible Gifts. And some people have told me it's their favorite chapter in the book, where I detail great inventions and stories and novels and pieces of music that have come into this world through the gates of dream. And it takes a person kind of awake in the dream to get it.
Right. Yeah, that's beautiful. That is. I do remember a musician telling me once that they were trying to learn something on the guitar, and they actually dreamed of Wes Montgomery, the jazz guitarist, who came to them in the dream and gave them some instructions on, and that's how they learned it. And I thought, wow, how fascinating that he was able to reach out to a teacher in the dream, you know, a teacher that has passed away, to get instructions.
It's a miraculous thing. Paul McCartney's song Yesterday got a haunting melody to it, and the melody appeared to McCartney in a dream, and he didn't know what it was about, and he told it to the other Beatles, and they kind of made fun of him, and they called it Scrambled Eggs, Oh My Darling, How I Love Your Legs. And that wasn't enough for McCartney. He became obsessed by the tune, and the tune led him to Yesterday, All My Troubles Seemed So Far Away. It goes together beautifully and became one of the most popular songs of all time. And so if you take the hint from the dream world, there are treasures on the other side kind of waiting to come apparitionally forward into this world. And that's where I think that's where all creativity comes from, is the unconscious mind and the archetypal psyche.
Yeah. And then, you know, there's so much in your book. People really have to get the book and read it, because there's no way we can cover everything. But you even talk about dreams between the mother and the unborn child.
Well, that's right. You're such a good reader, Andrea, that you bring up each thing gives me about 5 minutes of stuff. Stanley Krippner and Montague Ullman, who ran the Dream Research Lab at Maimonides Hospital in New York, have hypothesized that dream telepathy begins between the mother and the child while the child is still in the womb, and in which case the mother and the child are dreaming the same dream. Now, there's no way to prove that, because you can't put a stethoscope and say to the little fetus, hey, what's going on in there? But sometimes when the mother is dreaming or is in a REM state, a rapid eye movement state, the baby is moving coincidentally in the womb. And it seems like there may be synchronized psychic or emotional states that pass between mother and child.
Fascinating. Now, since you mentioned REM, can you explain dreaming and rapid eye movement, REM, for our audience?
Well, it wasn't understood until the 1950s in the lab of, it wasn't Joe Camilla, although he was involved in that early. It was Nathaniel Kleitman and a graduate student named Eugene Azarinsky. Azarinsky slept in the laboratory, not a comfortable place, but he was able to sleep there. And he was hooked up to EEG and EMG and heart monitors and all kinds of things. And there were these periodic disturbances that happened in the early part of the evening. Excuse me, I had a pretty bad cold yesterday.
Do you want to sip some water?
Early part of evening, there would be about 90 minutes apart, there would be these 10-minute bursts of activity, usually, not always, but usually accompanied by rapid eye movements. If you awaken the dreamer, Kleitman found during that time, they report dreams readily. If you wake them at a different time, when they are engaged in deep sleep and delta brain waves are supervening, then they may not remember a dream, or it may seem very far away. So that is how REM was discovered, rapid eye movement. Not always, but most of the time accompanies dreaming.
Now, if you sleep you always hear people should sleep 6, 7, 8 hours or whatever. What if you sleep for 3 hours? Can you have REM and if you only have 3 hours sleep?
Yep.
Oh, you can?
Yeah, the first cycle usually begins within about 90 minutes of falling asleep. So that's roughly an hour and a half. If you are sleep deprived, or if you fall asleep on a train or a bus during the day, they could start right away. That, in fact, leads to another story. I'm sorry, there are all these stories waiting in the wings to get out. That is how a German scientist discovered the benzene ring. He dozed off on a bus, and the first thing he dreamt of was an Ouroboros, a snake swallowing its tail. And then he dreamt of a bunch of little guys dancing in a circle holding hands. And it came back to him several times. He would doze off, and he would have these, what you call them, eidetic images. And then it took him a while to get it, and he said, "Oh, my God, I think I'm seeing the structure of the atoms." And that was how the benzene ring was discovered, and all of modern organic chemistry dates from that that dream insight.
Yeah. So how does prescription medicine, drugs, and alcohol impact our dreams?
Negatively.
Okay, negatively. Now, yeah. I know you don't like mentioning nightmares.
Well, they do. They are nightmarish. I have on more than one occasion found myself with some prescription medication in my system, usually something supposed to be for a different cause, like a sleep aid or something like that, and I'm more likely to get a nightmare under those conditions than other conditions. And marijuana just about cancels out dreams, and alcohol can distort the effect of dreaming as well. So none of those drug-induced altered states of consciousness are great for dreaming.
Now, you also say that there's a difference between nightmares and night terrors.
Yes. That is fully accepted in the realm of psychiatry and neurology. A night terror usually, not always, but usually happens to children, and they're whimpering or crying out or even moving out of bed or walking or something like that, but they can't be awakened to ordinary consciousness. They're screaming, they're frightened, but they can't tell you what it is. That's a night terror. So if you find a person sleepwalking, if you find a person out of bed with a night terror, or a child who wakes up, you know, screaming for something, it's better not to kind of totally wake them up. It's better to kind of coax them gently back into sleep and let them come out of it normally.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah.
So that's the best approach when dealing with a child who's having a night terror.
That's correct.
Wow.
And one of the wonderful, wonderful things that I and my staff have discovered in our little clinic here in the country is that I have never yet quite met a nightmare that I can't make go away for a little child. And nightmares are very frightening for little children. And night terrors are very, very frightening for parents because the child is obviously in distress and can't be wakened to talk about it. And one of the worst things, by the way, is to say, "Oh, don't worry, dear, it's not real." Because it is real for the child.
Yeah, it is real, right. It's
and
very
so,
real.
So with biofeedback or neurofeedback, which is something that I have practiced clinically for about 25, 30 years, it is possible to take the wind out of the sails of nightmares. I've got so many cases now after 1, 2, 3, maybe 5 treatments, the nightmares are gone. The night terrors, and the child has good, deep, restful sleep because you've kind of balanced the brain.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, you talk about how it normalizes the brain. And then the dreams become normalized, right? That's what you say in your book.
Yep.
Wow. So what about the suppression of dreams? And how do we unlock them?
Well, as I've told you, there are many, many drugs that are not the greatest thing for having dreams. Marijuana is regarded as a relatively harmless minor psychedelic, but it does have an onerosuppressive effect, that is, that it suppresses dreams. And I had one, I think about 15-year-old therapy client who told me he'd never dreamt. And but he was experimenting with, he was smoking pot every day, every night. And then one time, and unfortunately I was away on vacation, he took not only marijuana, he got drunk and took ecstasy at the same time. That's four different drugs in his nervous system. He had a kind of a psychotic break, was sent to the mental hospital, and by the time I came back from vacation, I realized that he had been through this whole thing. And I talked to him about, you can sort of mess yourself up pretty bad that way. So I talked him out of smoking pot every night, and all of a sudden his dreams just came back with a vengeance. It was like they'd all been locked in a closet, and here they came. And some of them were nightmarish, and some of them were instructive and very useful to him. So one way to get your dreams back is not to drink before you go to bed or not to smoke pot before you go to bed.
Yeah. So, you know, I do hear a lot of people say they don't remember their dreams, that they feel that they had dreams. They don't remember them. But also in your book, it says that if we lack deep sleep, we get increasingly exhausted and ill, even to the point of death. If we lack dreams, we become anxious, restless, and highly anxious. So for those people who don't remember, I mean, they feel like they dreamed, but they don't remember, they wouldn't necessarily be anxious or restless, correct? Because even though they don't remember them, they have a feeling.
They still have the dream. It still comes to them in a kind of a REM period or not. But there is the work of William Dement, D-E-M-E-N-T. We psychology students always used to call him Demented Dement. He woke up people as they were starting to dream. As he saw the REM activity commencing, he would wake them up. And so therefore, dream deprived them. Now, that's not the same as I was talking about with deep sleep. There's a book out called Why We Dream, and you can look at that book. I can't remember the name of the author right now, and I've only read reviews of the book, but if you are deprived of deep sleep long enough, that can be fatal or certainly lead to illness.
Wow.
But being deprived of dreams is not quite so serious. If you're deprived of dreams, you just are likely to get very, very anxious and lose your ability to concentrate. And that's what Dement showed.
So do we dream every night?
Yes.
We do.
The average number of dreams is somewhere between 5 and 8. Depends on how long you sleep. Depends on your age. Now, the infant not only starts dreaming REM dreams in the womb, as can be detected by physiological activity, but in the early days, weeks, and months of life, the infant is dreaming almost continuously. And you can tell that because of the REM sleep and the little movements that the infant makes. And it's a wonderful book by Thomas Verney called The Inner Life of the Unborn Child that goes into some of this. But so we start dreaming very early in life, and as you go through the life cycle, you dream less and less of the time. That's why I'm not necessarily a great fan of getting kids up at 6 o'clock in the morning to catch a 7 o'clock school bus. The poor dears are falling asleep by noontime. By afternoon, their heads are all down on their desks. They can't keep themselves awake, and kids just don't simply get enough sleep. In our media-based society, they stay up too late watching TV or playing computer games, and then they have to get up early in the morning. And they are definitely both sleep and dream deprived.
Yeah. So what are some of the things we can do to help us to remember our dreams?
Well, we have a whole chapter, that's Tom's chapter in the book. We have a whole chapter on that. And that chapter is how to remember your dreams and or how to take an active role in remembering your dreams. Because the funny thing is, Andrea, that dreams seem to know when we are aware of them and remember them, just like we are aware of whether we're dreaming or not, or whether we've had dreams or not. The dreams seem to know whether we take them seriously. I give the example of 2015, when I was actively involved in work on the dream book. I said, well, I'm normally a pretty good dreamer. I get about 50 in my journal every year, but I'm going to set my intention to remember my dreams. I got almost 250 dreams that year.
Wow, that's amazing.
Great detail. Yep.
Yeah, that's great. That's wonderful that you were able to tell yourself to do that, and then you were able to do it.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like you unlock something within yourself, and you were able to do it yourself.
Yep, and I've had pretty amazing dreams in this year. I mean, my dreams aren't ordinary dreams. They are very often instructive in how to work with dreams, how other people can work with dreams. It's like you're going to university at night.
Right. Yeah. So why is it important to consider keeping a dream journal to help us understand our dreams and to connect the dots between the sleeping and waking state?
Yeah. You keep asking them. The importance of a dream journal is, this takes us back to the chapter on the psychoneurology or the psychophysiology of dreaming. There really is a difference in brain activity in dream as opposed to waking consciousness. The neurotransmitter environment is quite different. When we are asleep and dreaming, it's predominantly acetylcholine that is active, and when we're awake, it's the epinephrine or norepinephrine metabolism that is going on. Furthermore, there are circuits, as Hobson and McCarley show in their Harvard-based research. There are circuits in the brain that are involved and implicated in dreaming that are not implicated in waking consciousness, even though both realms do interpenetrate with each other. For example, we can remember dreams. Some of my dreams, I just remember, oh, I didn't write that one down, but now I see it. Oh, yeah, there it is. And I'm in a car or something like that. It comes to me. Now, in dreams, then, of course, often our dreams are about waking life. And if you're writing a novel or you're a creative composer, that quest will get into your dream, and that's how some of the most amazing creative dream ideation have come into being, like the Yesterday song that McCarthy wrote.
Yeah. You have so much in the book. You even reference partners in dreaming, which is fascinating. And then, of course, we did touch on it briefly. People have to get the book. We talk about prophecy. We did talk about it a bit. Clairvoyance and intuition in dreams.
Well, even though I'm a pretty good scientist, I have come to accept those, because no matter what official science says, you can't eliminate the evidence of your own psyche. And yes, I researched quite a bit of the lore, particularly collected during the 1960s when people, for some reason, were taking these things more seriously at Maimonides Hospital. And they were having people dream of others' dreams halfway down the hall in a hospital building. Somebody would be meditating on a picture and thinking strongly of the dreamer, you know, a couple hundred feet away. The dreamer would say, I think I see a painting, and it's a painting of what's that guy, Paul Gauguin? No, Vincent van Gogh. And that's exactly what the dreamer was trying to send to the, that's what the sender was trying to send to the dreamer in this experimentation. So when you take that research material seriously, there's no way these things can happen by mere coincidence or by chance. I think there were 45 people who dreamt of the sinking of the Titanic.
Wow. That's something.
And there wasn't the media communication that we have now. Somebody wasn't on a cell phone saying, oh, we're going down, we're dying. It was a different kind of cell phone.
Right. Yeah, that's amazing. Now, in your book, you also discuss, which we briefly touched upon, African Americans and psychic abilities, as well as women dreamers, including Joan of Arc and Harriet Tubman. You also cover famous visionaries of Europe. And, of course, we touched upon this, music and dreams, science and dreams. I mean, the book is very, very thorough. You also talk about Edgar Cayce, and who is called the Sleeping Prophet. And I didn't realize this, that he actually became clairvoyant after a traumatic brain injury. I didn't realize that.
He fell off a porch as, I think, a 4 or 5 year old boy and was impaled through the top of his head by a nail. And they didn't know what to do, so they poured turpentine in the wound, and he went on as usual. And not a few months after that, he began talking to angels.
Yeah, that's something. Now, can you explain the term lucid dreaming?
Well, lucid dreaming is the inverse of daydreaming, in that at night we take on, as it were, daytime consciousness in the dream. One of my favorite examples of this is in an old friend and colleague of mine, Wilson Van Dusen, who's now passed on, but he was in a dream, and some Air Force officers wearing uniforms came into the room to take him away or something. They were authority figures. And he noticed, wait a minute, there's something a little funny about their uniforms and their insignia. Wait a minute, I must be dreaming. And he woke up, in a sense, in the dream at that point. Now, when you wake up in the dream, you can take a kind of a more active role in the dream. Another example Van Dusen gave was somebody tossed a vase out a window, and he remembered listening in the dream for the crash, and it didn't happen for about 10 seconds. He said, oh, there it is. Wait a minute.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah.
Gravity doesn't work the same way in dreams. And so you wake up in the dream. Now, both Tom and I bring up that lucid dreaming ought to be available to us all. We ought to be instructed in this when we're children, just like my mother instructed me that I could confront the nightmarish figure in my dream and say, hey, wait a minute, this is my dream. Why don't you drink decaf coffee? Why are you attacking little boys like this? You know, you can confront the monsters in your dreams and then, in a sense, take on, as Tom says in one of his chapters, he says, where the fear is, that's where the power is.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's a great book. I love it because I've always been fascinated with dreams since I was a young child. And so can we direct our dreams by making specific requests for answers to questions, solutions for problems? And I kind of laugh when I ask you that. But
that's called dream incubation. Began with the ancient Greeks.
Yeah. Because I remember having a situation, I didn't know how to handle it. And before I went to sleep, I said, I want an answer to this. How do I handle this? And when I woke up in the morning, I knew exactly what to do. That's why I laughed when I asked that, because
Wonderful.
I don't know, was it a dream or was it just that I was less stressed and relaxed and could figure it out? But
well, it's not for nothing that they say better to sleep on it.
Right.
Because your mind changes, it goes through metamorphoses. And by the way, think about that word metamorphoses. That comes from one of the Oniroi, Morpheus, the shape-changing dreamer. I give an example of Morpheus-type dreams in the book. And, you know, what we were looking for, Andrea, was a way to bring this marvelous hidden resource that is available to each and every one of us into modern consciousness, so we don't just dismiss things by saying, "Ah, that was just a dream. Forget it. Get
right.
over it."
Yeah.
No, because you're in a sense negating the richness, the depth inside you, and that's not a good thing to do. You may find yourself very alienated from yourself.
Yeah. It's wonderful talking to you. The book is so thorough. I mean, you cover pretty much all aspects of dreaming that you could think of. I mean, you go through the historical perspective, and so people really should read the book. Do you have anything to share that we have not covered? And do you have any closing reflections? And then I was going to read another excerpt from your wonderful book.
Well, you're such a good reader, Andrea. You've never ceased to impress and amaze me with the thoroughness that you put into reading, and I wish I had as much time to read as you do.
Well, this is kind of what I do. So I make a point to read the book, because in order to have these wonderful conversations with people like you, it helps to read it. It becomes so it's a very special experience. Always special reading your books, because you're so thoughtful. You put so much heart and spirit in what you do.
Well, thank you for saying that, and thank you for sharing your own little dream experience there, because it's profound. We carry a problem from waking consciousness into dreams, and then the creative unconscious rises up and says, "Hey, take a look at this."
And the thing that's so fascinating about that, Steve, is that when you wake up, it's like it wasn't that complicated. It felt complicated before you went to sleep, right? But then when you relax and you let go of it the next day, it's not that complicated. Sometimes we make things more difficult.
Yes, that's true. That's true. So I very much appreciate this interview. I'm afraid I'm losing my voice a little bit, and both of us have had colds, so I want to thank you for your courage and your fortitude in being willing to interview me under that adversity, and so we can finish up with whatever you wanted to read from the book.
Yeah, I will read, yeah. There's so many that people really have to get the book. It's a wonderful book. And it says, "The religious alchemical maxim, in my patience is my soul, expresses a great deal of wisdom and guidance for working with our dreams. The rewards of dream work are immense, but they often come, as with most spiritual work, at the end, after hours of quiet, attentive, creative work. This often hard, slow work is beautifully expressed in the powerful poem Night Work by Thomas McGrath, where the dreamer upon awakening finds the world hardly changed at all. The psyche changes slowly, but it hardly changes. The soul grows and deepens through patient, hard, creative work. One of the marvels of dream work is that it not only gives us transformative images and experiences, but also gives us the energy to live these transformative images in our waking lives. Dream work is natural change. As Marie-Louise von Franz says, dreams are the voice of nature within us. We change in response to the all-night chipping on the stones of sleep, on the old known statue of solitude. We hardly change, but we change in deep, transformed ways.
I think I'd like to hire you to be a reader of this book.
I love reading your book.
Do a very good of it.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And, you know, thank you again for your great work.
Thanks so much, Andrea. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
And it's always a pleasure. And I'm looking forward to your next project. And people should visit innertraditions.com, which is the publishing company, stonemountaincenter.com, correct? And
yes.
magicianwithoutborders.com.
That's right. And the one book I didn't publish with Inner Traditions is the Fundamentalist Mind, and that's with Quest Books, and it's still in print.
I love that book. And people have to read that as well. Read all your books. That's what I say. Okay. Well, it's been a real pleasure.
Sleep well.
Okay. Thank you.
Sweet dreams.
Okay. Thank you. Take care, Stephen.
Bye, Andrea.
I would like to thank our guest, author Dr. Stephen Larson, for being here to discuss the book, The Transformational Power of Dreaming, Discovering the Wishes of the Soul. And that book is by Stephen Larson and Tom Verner. For more information, visit innertraditions.com, stonemountaincenter.com, and magicianwithoutborders.com. I would like to encourage all of our listeners to practice the universal law of giving by doing whatever you can to reach out to help others. To each and every one of you out there, thank you so much for joining me, Andrea Garrison, and connecting here online with Andrea. Listen to me live or listen to the archive. Just continue connecting heart to heart. But in the meantime, do whatever you can to reach out to help others and never underestimate the power of a friendly smile. Take care.
Thank you for connecting to Online with Andrea with your host, Andrea Garrison.